230 are alive. There's still no deal for their release. Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer was asked on ABC's This Week about Israel's operations against Hamas.
So we have been clear to the IDF that they need to handle this situation in a very sensitive, very delicate way. And that's an area of ongoing conversation between us and the government of Israel.
More than 30 babies were evacuated from the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza. That's the hospital the World Health Organization called a death zone. Israel's raided the hospital, saying it believes Hamas uses it as headquarters. Rain and storms expected today in Texas and Oklahoma, which could complicate travel for the tens of thousands of people beginning their Thanksgiving week travel. Three women and a teenage girl were shot and killed in three locations across Memphis in what authorities describe as a domestic incident. The suspect was killed. This is ABC News. Authorities in Los Angeles say they have a person of interest in connection with the fire that shut down a part of Interstate 10 in the city. Cal Fire released photos of a man described as 30 to 35 years old, 6 feet tall, with a knee brace on his right leg. Work continues to finish repairs on the freeway, which is set to reopen by Tuesday. The American Civil Liberties Union demanding a Kansas school district change its policy around boys' hair.
The ACLU in a letter demanding the Girard School District rescind a policy that bars long hair for boys, alleging it violates state and federal laws. The issue came to a head after a grade school forced an 8-year-old Native American boy to cut off his hair. The boy, a member of the Wyandot Nation, was following a custom of cutting hair only when mourning the loss of a loved one. The district superintendent says the dress code policy will be reviewed during a meeting in December.
It's ABC's Mark Remillard. Someone returned the famous composer's book to the St. Paul Public Library in Minnesota. A slip found in the book shows that it was checked out in 1919. Brian Clark, ABC News.
The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is here and ready to help. Anyone can call or text 988 or chat via 988wisconsin.org to get connected to a trained Lifeline counselor. Trained counselors are here to support anyone experiencing a suicidal, mental health, or substance use crisis. You can also contact 988 if you are concerned about someone. 988 is confidential and free to all Wisconsin residents. 988, 24/7. Call, text, chat. Here to support you. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
Be a part of the resistance. Check out The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson, Monday nights at 7 on Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK and on the Civic Media app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came in.
I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News. Studies show people who live in rural communities have a life expectancy 3 years fewer than people who live in urban areas. Mike Moan reports now on efforts to plan to prevent these deaths.
Across rural America, health experts say factors like ambulance shortages and hospital closures add to access issues for patients, leading to poorer outcomes. The American Heart Association notes that rural populations are 40% more likely to develop heart disease. AHA's Tim Nicolai says that's why his organization is working with small towns and cities to build a nation of lifesavers for when a rural resident experiences a heart attack.
Are the people and the organizations around them prepared to respond with effective CPR, with utilization of an AED, and kind of just having that entire system in place?
Municipalities that apply for the designation are given tools to evaluate gaps in getting residents trained and fitting buildings with the proper equipment. Nicolai says schools should be a major priority for any readiness planning.
There's dozens or hundreds of students there day in and day out. There's dozens of staff members. There's often parents and other volunteers visiting during the school day. And then you think about athletic events and community events that are often housed in schools.
He says schools should not only make sure staff are trained, but also make sure automated external defibrillators, or AEDs, are placed in visible locations and are accessible after hours. Nicolai says churches, food pantries, and community centers are other places to add to a readiness plan. Local leaders wanting to pursue a certification can contact the state health department. AHA also has details on its website where communities and businesses can build their plan. This is Mike Bowen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bow.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Here's your updated forecast. Highs around 49 this afternoon under mainly clear skies, southeasterly winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Overcast tonight, 33. 44 tomorrow, cloudy. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on Lake Air, WLAK, 1260 AM. Right now, 39.
From the heart of the St. Croix Valley, we're in touch with you. You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station. UAUK.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning once again. This is our second hour on Saturday, November 18th, 2023. Thank you so much. I'm honored to have you join me for this second hour of our discussion of law and government and justice in America. Also taking your phone calls, as always, at 844-967-2789. Also taking and appreciating, encouraging your written comments, your questions in particular about the subject matters of our syllabus today, going online, Civic Media website, your broadcast station, and identifying Morning Cannoli as the folder and sending us those questions or comments that you may have. Anya with me here in the studios of WAUK in downtown beautiful Waukesha, engaging this morning in discussion about cases both important and significant in our lives. One of those having to do with the determination by a jury just this past week, a federal jury impaneled in Louisville, Kentucky, finding that it could not make a determination on federal civil rights charges brought against a former police detective in Louisville. His name is Brett Hankinson, talking right before the break about the ruling by the jury there and the important judgment then entered, at least in part preliminarily, by the judge presiding over that case, declaring a mistrial. And what this means, of course, procedurally, is that although there is not a final judgment, a disposition in this particular prosecution, the government, the U.S. Department of Justice, the assistant U.S. attorneys there in Louisville do have the option, if they choose to pursue it, to retry this case. Double jeopardy does not attach in a circumstance like this where a jury fails to come to a unanimous verdict beyond a reasonable doubt, sending notes to the judge. They were unable to do that based upon these charges of federal violations of the civil rights of Breonna Taylor, who was tragically, catastrophically brought down during the course of this raid on her apartment in 2022, bringing the end of her life at that time. During the course of the trial, former detective Hankinson, who was fired following the shooting, was describing what happened at the time. In particular, the allegation was that he had fired several times through a covered window and into a sliding glass door during this nighttime police execution of the search warrant. Significantly, those bullets did not hit Ms. Breonna Taylor. They were not responsible for her death. They went into an apartment of an adjacent neighbor. And in that neighbor's apartment, a woman who happened to be pregnant at the time, her boyfriend, a five-year-old, were sleeping at the time. They likewise not hit, but nonetheless, the danger, the possibility of that prompts the government to charge Brett Hankinson with these federal civil rights violations, not only in connection with his activities overall in the death of Breonna Taylor, but also the general conduct. And in the course of this trial, Hankinson says that he did, in fact, have legal justification for using this kind of deadly force when he fired those shots. He testified in particular that he felt frightened, that he and his other officers were very much of the view that they were helpless, he said. Believed that someone inside the apartment was continuing to fire at them, for which there is some factual support. Those shots coming through the apartment door shortly after midnight on March 13th of 2020. An awful lot of confusion, an awful lot of melee that results once again in the tragic death of Breonna Taylor. Lots of litigation coming from this, including by the family. Lots of criminal prosecution. Again, previously, Mr. Hankinson was acquitted by a state jury for those same kinds of things, endangering Ms. Taylor's neighbors by firing those shots into the home and landing into the apartment of the adjacent neighbor there. Acquitted by a prior state jury. And under these circumstances, the federal government does assess whether or not the interests of justice have been met and determine in this case that an appropriate federal prosecution should follow that unsuccessful state prosecution that resulted in a verdict of not guilty. Here, once again, disposition, ultimate disposition, not accomplished by virtue of the fact that a jury did not come to a verdict. We acknowledge, as we always must, the importance, the significance of the jury system, the determinations they make in all of these cases. And so no one inside the Department of Justice is maintaining that somehow the jury necessarily went awry here. Nonetheless, a determination to be made by the Department of Justice, by the U.S. attorney there, by others, about whether or not to charge this case, to pursue the charges existing in another trial, and pursuing once again the view that justice has not yet been accomplished, at least with respect to Detective Hankinson. Along the way, significant in this matter also, that as a part of the Breonna Taylor investigation, the Justice Department also conducted an independent civil review of the Louisville Police Department and determined in the end that it had a pattern and practice of abusive and discriminatory behavior, perhaps also illustrated by the very incident that resulted in Breonna Taylor's death, the actions by the detective Hankinson here and his colleagues on that day. Government's report finding that the department there in Louisville had shown a broad pattern of discrimination against Black people and those with behavioral health problems in the city of Louisville. Those things presumably the focus of not only attention by the Department of Justice, but also by virtue of this process to affect change so that the Breonna Taylor situation is not repeated in the future and that training is undertaken, that conduct is consistent with established principles that understand the service-related focus of all law enforcement. That also a part of the important Department of Justice attempt to ensure that our law enforcement authorities are brought to justice, not only in terms of criminal prosecutions. This one, we'll see whether or not the Department of Justice pursues yet another trial of this particular defendant, but also civilly, also administratively, to ensure that going forward, police agencies, law enforcement entities like the one in Louisville do not affect these kinds of historical discriminatory practices, again, with respect to people of color and also those with behavioral health problems. We will continue to monitor that case and others in the future on this broadcast. I promised as a part of our continuing discussion with you that we would, and we always will, take callers and your comments, your questions. We have had some callers in the past, always callers, bringing to our attention questions, comments about the things on our syllabus, and this morning is no exception. Delighted to have with us from Merrimack this morning, Jack is on the line. Jack, thanks for calling in this morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to address something that you stated in the first half of the program, which I realize that you're trying to keep an open-handed approach or open-minded approach to the fact that there is no place for violence in our political system in this country, no matter which political party you come from. But I also wanted to emphasize there really is only one political party that is participating in significant violence or threats or attempts at violence. And that started prior to this, it started when the leader of that political party at one of his rallies encouraged his followers to go after protesters, and he even said he'd pay the legal fees for them. The same person has also referred to the insurrectionists from January 6th at the Capitol as patriots, and said that if he is reelected, he will pardon those who have been convicted of this violence, for which there is no excuse in this country. He continues to lie about the election, inciting his followers. And not only that, but the major figures in that political party besides this person have not even rejected these facts or these contentions that the 2020 election was fraudulent. I mean, this has got to stop. Until it stops with this political party, we will see continued political violence of the type that was directed against Nancy Pelosi and her husband. And even now, even though he's been ordered by a judge not to attack members of the court and witnesses, this guy still continues to do so.
Jack, important points all, and I will add to that. Yes, indeed, the direction, the deterrent impact of what we're saying should apply to everybody. And hopefully it lands. It lands also in the desk, in the lap of our former president. You're absolutely right. Along the way, in addition to the things that you've identified, this is someone who has also said that if you come after me, I'll come after you. That's exactly the kind of thing, that kind of incendiary comments, in addition to all the other things you've identified here this morning, that cannot be a part of our political discourse. It's not what America is about. It's not. It is not protected by the First Amendment. Those issues, I know, much on appeal right now by courts determining whether or not the so-called gag orders will remain in place. But your points are so well taken, so well taken. It's a lot about language, right? And the message that we send, especially officials in positions of responsibility, of authority, whether or not you're the president of the United States of America or running for that office, people listen to you. And indeed, that's exactly what David DePape and others have commented about. So many people on January 6th said encouraged to engage in the violence in which they engaged precisely because the president said they should do that. Encouraging that, could not agree more, that words have meaning and that, again, the lessons need to apply across the board. Absolutely, absolutely, we are sending that message to everyone in our nation. Appreciate very much the call, the comment, Jack, as well. And right after this upcoming break, we're going to take more callers along the way. And we're also going to be chatting more about precisely that. That is the January 6th investigation, the prosecution, the decisions made by Judge Chutkan this past week, the implications of that. Stay with us for that discussion. And stay with us also for more calls, more comments from our listeners. Always highly valued and appreciated on this broadcast.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
Thanksgiving will be here soon, and I can't wait to spend the day with family and friends just catching up, playing games, and settling in for a big turkey dinner. This may sound weird, but my favorite part of a big turkey dinner is the gravy. I pour it on my turkey, potatoes, stuffing, and there's always plenty of Village Heart dinner rolls to help soak up every drop. And whether you prefer classic white or wheat, 12-grain or sweet Hawaiian, a basket of warm Village Heart dinner rolls is the natural choice for Thanksgiving dinner.
You probably heard the quote, friends are family you choose. It's also the idea behind the other Thanksgiving holiday, Friendsgiving. Some credit shows, like Friends, for starting this trend by featuring a day meant to celebrate with those who aren't your relatives. And when to gather is up to you. Many celebrate just before Thanksgiving, while others wait until after the official holiday. However you celebrate, all of us with your local Civic Media radio station wish you a wonderful holiday season. I'm Terry Barr.
The Todd Allman
You're listening
Show.
To what Lake really Air 1260 AM WLAK.
I'm willing to listen. You are. We are human beings. People have their beliefs for a whole lot of reasons. Some of them are rational, maybe some of them not.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate the call, Stephanie.
We are back
Look,
here
we
on
just
our
need to
Saturday
listen
morning
to
broadcast.
Each other. Doesn't mean we always have to agree on what facts are. But we do have to listen to one another
Joe,
if we want to try
and
get this country
Madison
back on track.
This morning. Joe, glad to have you with me once again
on
this Saturday morning.
On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Thanks very much. As always, a really terrific show, and I really appreciate the effort that you put in to talk about just the costs that are associated with prosecuting cases within the DOJ. It's expensive, and it's to give everybody a fair shake. It costs and in time and money and energy, and I thought that the time that you spent elaborating on that was really important. In light of that, and also looking at the comments that caller Jack had just before the break, I'm curious to get your reaction to the actions of Speaker Mike Johnson, who in the last day, 24 hours, has made the decision to do what many of his right-wing pals want, which is to release 44,000 hours of video footage from the hundreds of security cameras that are within the Capitol area. And there have been concerns that this may affect the security of the staff who works in this area, but also those in Congress in terms of people being able to use this to try to figure out how to basically plan the next attack. And there's also concerns that after the efforts that were put in by the January 6th committee, that there will again be this will create new narratives as to what happened, because, man, I know you can pull the shots from certain camera to say this certain thing, and taken out of context, it can give you a completely different take on a particular situation that is also very, very far from the truth. So I'm curious, as you look at why this is being released now and the speaker's efforts to release this footage after all of the work that the January 6th committee did to address the security concerns and also to relay the story of what happened on that day. What do you think is going on here? Is this just appeasing his right-wing pals? Is this meant to gum up the works? Because it certainly seems like it would. I'd be curious your reactions as a federal prosecutor when you look at this being released and the timing of it being released. Thanks a lot. I await your response. Thanks.
Joe, thanks so much for that comment and that question. With which I concur. As a federal prosecutor, one of the things we always do is we try to balance the interests of the public in knowing. We've talked a lot on this broadcast about the importance of transparency and providing information to the public to ensure that they know that cases are being investigated appropriately. Even though we can't disclose everything along the way, we do that how? We do that in a trial. That's a public proceeding. That's one of the reasons why, just to divert from this very important focus that you provided, Joe, the other great concern I have just this past week is the decision by defense counsel in this Georgia case to release the tapes of the now cooperating defendants in that case. Very different from what Mike Johnson has done with respect to the tapes of the January 6th insurrection, the attack on our Capitol. But the same kind of thing. You wonder out loud and you wonder with good purpose why that is being done. Well, it's trying to, yes, arguably, superficially respond to public interest. That public interest, I will say, is not compromised by not releasing that. There's no First Amendment violation by having prosecutors not release that information. Why? Because it ensures the integrity in that Georgia case of the upcoming trial. It ensures that the presentation that will be made to the public down the road of those witness statements, those people now cooperating, former defendants, all of those people will be presented, and we will have a full chance, pursuant to the First Amendment and rights of transparency, to hear all that. but it is not so great an interest that it should compromise the safety and security of those witnesses, the legitimacy of the trials that are going ahead. The same, Joe, as you noted, applies to this situation as well. We know not only that based upon what the House Select Committee has done, its findings, but I would argue no less important, perhaps even more importantly, that this prosecution, the January 6th federal prosecution, is going ahead probably in March of 2024. Some significant concerns, I think, about whether or not all the pretrial matters can be taken care of by then. But nonetheless, Judge Chutkan, very committed to ensuring the integrity of that process. When these kinds of tapes are done, I recognize that people say, good, we've got the information. The public has a right to see that. And the answer is, yes, they do. It is a right, however, that is conditioned upon an even greater concern about the legitimacy of a criminal prosecution and the investigation. It's not simply deferred. It is also a part of the fundamental notions based upon which those investigations and prosecutions are conducted. I agree with you, Joe, that when these kinds of tapes are released, two significant things happen. One is we're talking about safety and security once again. 44,000 video footage of all of this, an awful lot of that, plainly within the ambit of security and safety, not only for the people who are responsible for protecting our nation's capital and the people sent there to represent us, but also the very integrity of the process there. It does compromise that. It opens up the door to that. And one has to say that the release of all of those tapes can also be the subject of the second point that you made, Joe, which is the uses of it to expand upon, to promote a counter-narrative to what will be presented in the trials themselves. And that is that somehow this was not a violent insurrection. Somehow this was, as members of Congress have sometimes said, just visitors to the Capitol. That is not the case. And yet, as you noted, you will be able to find among that video footage some indications of people milling around as if they're simply on the Capitol grounds on Capitol Hill that day. All of that, contrary to the best interests of our nation, best interests of our people, no violations of the First Amendment in not releasing that, because there are greater concerns related to the safety and security. And to the extent that there are First Amendment rights, those will in fact be vindicated. They'll be vindicated during the course of not only of hearings in front of the Congress, as we have seen, but also most importantly, these trials that will be happening in the District of Columbia in front of Judge Chutkan, and also, by the way, in Georgia. Those kinds of things can also have an impact, as I said before, upon things going on in that setting as well. Very concerned about these kinds of things, seemingly in the interest of transparency, and yet not in the best interest of the legitimacy of the prosecutions going ahead. And I say that not only for the purposes of the prosecution, the Department of Justice, but actually it protects the defendants as well when these things are not disclosed. Defendants have a right to a fair and decent and just trial. It is compromised. It is compromised when these kinds of releases are made, and that should be a source of great concern for every single American. Joe, appreciate the comment. Appreciate the question quite a bit. We know as well that Judge Chutkan, in addition to presiding over this case, likely anticipating a trial in March of this coming year, just this past week, she has once again entered an order that is important in understanding the case. The defense, on behalf of Donald Trump, requested to strike some information, some so-called inflammatory allegations about the events at the Capitol that we're talking about from the criminal indictment that we've talked about. The judge said no. The judge said that the allegations there are relevant, that they are consistent with past practices. The court is not going to provide a copy of the indictment to the jurors, but the information set forth in the indictment will be presented by the prosecutors in their discretion in the trial. That happening by Judge Chutkan just yesterday as a part of her administration of the case. Again, balancing the interests of the defense and the prosecution and all of us to that fair and decent trial coming up in 2024. When we come back, we're going to talk more about January 6th and then also talk about other important matters in the history, the contemporary history of the rule of law in our country.
Connecting with
with you on air, online, and on the Civic Media app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM, WLAK,
Amory's radio station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The U.S. government says it believes the majority of hostages held by Hamas, more than 230, are alive. There's still no deal for their release. Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer was asked on ABC's This Week about Israel's operations against Hamas.
So we have been clear to the IDF that they need to handle this situation in a very sensitive, very delicate way. And that's an area of ongoing conversation between us and the government of Israel.
More than 30 babies were evacuated from the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza. That's the hospital the World Health Organization called a death zone. Israel's raided the hospital, saying it believes Hamas uses it as headquarters. Rain and storms expected today in Texas and Oklahoma, which could complicate travel for the tens of thousands of people beginning their Thanksgiving week travel. Three women and a teenage girl were shot and killed in three locations across Memphis in what authorities describe as a domestic incident. The suspect was killed. This is ABC News.
Overtime. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Nebraska jumped out to a 14-point lead in the first half, but the Wisconsin Badgers battled back to send the game into overtime and get the win, 24-17. Braylon Allen with a 3-yard run to score the winning touchdown, ending a 3-game losing streak. Badgers head coach Luke Fickell.
Well, winning's a whole different feeling, so I wasn't kidding. I mean, you guys have seen me the last couple weeks. You see me on the Monday press conferences, and it's been a stretch, you know, on all of us. I think, you know, every kid in that locker room, every coach in our program, and to get a win tonight, it's so great. I mean, it's deep.
Wisconsin travels to Minnesota next week. NBA, the Bucks with a 132-125 win over the Mavericks. Milwaukee scoring in 7 of their last 9 possessions to get the win in the fourth quarter. Adrian Griffin.
You know, your fourth quarter got to be your best quarter, especially when you're playing a terrific team like Dallas.
That's Bucks head coach Adrian Griffin with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Here's your updated forecast. Highs around 49 this afternoon under mainly clear skies, southeasterly winds, 8 to 15 miles per hour. Overcast tonight, 33. 44 tomorrow, cloudy. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on Lake Air, WLAK, 1260 AM. Right now, 42.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
I'm not even clear from conflicting headlines whether or not Robin Voss has the cojones to move forward with impeachment against Megan Multh. Why would he do such a thing? You know, just a couple of weeks after he said he wasn't going to do such a thing. Well, he's been threatened, huh? By what? A group headed by his primary opponent, Adam Steed.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Let's talk about the debate over stadium renovations at American Family Field, what the team's going to kick in, what they're willing to kick in, what state legislators are willing to approve. There have been some more adjustments to the bill, and I'll admit I haven't talked much about it because I feel like everything's all still rather fluid.
I think fluid is the right word, Pat. You're a man of words. Way to go. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning, 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
The owner of a Michigan rental that's called The Castle is being sued by a group of 7 women who stayed there, found it consumed with bats.
Tell the best part, though.
The exterminator allegedly found multiple inches of bat guano kicking the floor.
I think I just threw up a little bit in my mouth. Oh, my God.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Brock. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Like smelt fries and music on the river, we're uniquely Amory. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station.
We are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast talking once again about January 6th and the issue of disclosures into the public domain, not only of huge amount of video footage of January 6th, but also other cases, including the Georgia case in which tapes were released, leaked by one of the defense counsel this past week, anticipating next year and beyond the trial of that case, the impact that that can have, and the importance of understanding that these things do have a detrimental and can have a wildly detrimental impact upon the very administration of justice, impact upon witnesses who may be disinclined to come forward and testify, impact upon a jury pool, and impact upon the general results that come from jury deliberations when these kinds of things are presented in the public domain, not necessarily within the four confines of the courtroom, which is the focus of these trials. During the course of the break, Gene sent a note in to Anya, my terrific producer, asking about what we can do. What can we do when these decisions are made seemingly unilaterally? Well, I hate to sound defeatist. I will not sound defeatist, but indicate that in part Mike Johnson's decision is out there. This footage is out there now. And what do we do in response to that is how I'm going to interpret Gene's very good and thoughtful comment. And one of them, of course, is to voice your opposition to it, to articulate this notion that the First Amendment rights to know the public interest in transparency is not inviolate, it's not unconditional, and then indeed there are reasons why, both in the courtrooms and in the public opinion generally, the court of public opinion, these things are not helpful and productive. What do? You write, as I've advocated on many other circumstances, let your elected representatives know about this, send messages not only to the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, send notes and comments to your federal and state officials, the people you send to these positions of responsibility, letting them know that you support the balanced work of prosecutors, investigators, people who are responsible for ensuring justice is done, balancing, yes, the interest of the public in knowing what's going on, but recognize that this kind of conduct is not in the general public interest, letting them know about your objection to that. And you can do more, Gene. You can also be out there finding among those great volumes of tape already released those indications that, yes, indeed, this was a violent assault upon our nation. That's the reason why people are already pleading guilty to some conduct in Georgia, in other places for that kind of thing. That's the reason why these prosecutions are going forward, by grand juries finding by probable cause that this conduct did take place. Those charges going forward in trials, commenting and providing the response to those people who would derive from this an inappropriate and closed-minded narrative based upon something that did not happen, which is a peaceful event on January 6th. It was violent. It was violent, and we know that. We know that based upon the approximately 1,200 people who have already either pled guilty, been adjudicated guilty in the trial court in Washington, D.C. Make reference to those folks. Make reference to those people, like just this past week, a Utah activist and supposed journalist. His name is John Sullivan. He is now facing up to 30 years in prison for his involvement in the violent mob on that day. He was one of those people who recorded the shooting of Ashley Babbitt. Remember her? Sullivan's video footage captured the very moment when Babbitt, who was the 35-year-old Air Force veteran, was fatally wounded as she attempted to breach a window into the speaker's lobby. Sullivan himself now found guilty of that kind of conduct in violation of federal law. Along the way, he can be heard saying on his own video, and I'm going to clean this up for purposes of our broadcast, he said, "We did this stuff." He says, "We took this stuff," and he said, "Let's burn this stuff down," in his own video. He maintains he was just a journalist on that day. Prosecutors, of course, say just the opposite. He's the kind of person, Gene, that you identify as somebody who is in violation of federal law, violation of our basic norms. Indeed, the assistant director in charge of the FBI's Washington office said, got it just right. He said, "The First Amendment does not give anyone license to incite violence or engage in criminal activity." That's the lesson, Gene, that you can bring to those people who would bandy about the video footage that says something else, that sends a message that is not consistent with the truth. Write to your representatives. Let people know. Do your own advocacy about that. And know that judges out there, admittedly in the context of their own cases, are also sending those same kinds of messages to defendants. And more, these orders directing that defendants, in particular Donald Trump, not be out there commenting about these kinds of things. One of them on appeal right now to the New York court. Another of them on appeal to the federal court. Both of them almost assuredly going to be affirmed by those higher courts. Nothing about the stays of those orders indicates that the judges on appeal have indicated there's something wrong with restricting the statements made by a defendant that are contrary to the best interests of justice, commenting upon witnesses, commenting upon the jury pool, commenting on the legitimacy of things going on in the courtroom. Those kinds of things, again, like the release of these videos in Georgia, in Washington, D.C., are not helpful. They're contrary to best interests. They do not promote the rule of law. Appreciate, Gene, your very good comment, just as we appreciate the comments of Jack and Joe earlier in our broadcast. All of that, all a part of our continuing focus of January 6th, noting along the way a matter that also underscores deterrent impact, but focuses upon what's happening in America. Jacob Chansley, you probably recall him as the QAnon shaman, filed just this past week a statement of interest that he intends to run in 2024 as a Libertarian candidate in the election of Arizona's 8th Congressional District Representative. You may recall him. He pled guilty to a felony charge of obstructing the official proceedings there on January 6th, connection with the insurrection and the riot. He was sentenced to 41 months in federal prison. That's still uncompleted. He was recently transferred to a federal halfway house, but still under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Prisons. He appears to be running for Congress. He wants to return to the very house, the very people's house that he attacked back on January 6th of 2021. Believe it or not, there's no constitutional prohibition on felons holding federal office, but in an interesting twist on all of this, Arizona law prohibits an individual from voting until a criminal sentence is completed. Jacob Chansley, if indeed he does pursue his candidacy for that, not going to be able to vote for himself. We'll see if the representatives in the 8th Congressional District look upon him and say that's the kind of person we want to send to the United States Congress, send back to the Congress after he attempted, through the work of his own and that of others, to undermine the process on that day. I mentioned already that the Georgia judge presiding over the case in Georgia also indicating along the way, entering orders along the way, locking down what he calls some sensitive evidence, specifically these tapes that have been released by defense counsel, these tapes of statements made by now cooperating defendants in that matter. The judge in that case locking down, telling the attorneys they cannot release this information, contrary, again, to the rules of the court, contrary to the basic discovery procedures pursuant to which they're given this information. Why? To ensure that the defense has the proper and full opportunity to present a defense in the case not intended for public release in violation of the fundamental notions of things that go on in courts. Also in that Atlanta case, that Fulton County case, the prosecutor, Fannie Willis, seeking to revoke the bond of one of those 19 defendants in that case. His name is Harrison Floyd because he's engaged in numerous intentional and flagrant violations of his bond release. And in particular, Fannie Willis indicates that Floyd, who is a former leader of something called Black Voices for Trump, is facing charges related to his harassment of campaign targeting two of the election workers. You know them well. They're Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss. Falsely accused of election fraud in the aftermath of the 2020 campaign. He's pleaded not guilty in that matter, but along the way, he has provided information on his own social media account, including X, which is formerly known as Twitter, mentioning these election officials, others who are likely witnesses in the case, all of that meant to intimidate witnesses, affect the jury pool there. Fannie Willis seeking to have his bond revoked, seeking to be brought into court and thrown in jail for doing those kinds of things in violation of his release, in violation of, again, the basic trappings pursuant to which our courts in America are administered. All of that going on in the courts of our nation, In addition, some basic news, some very important news breaking out of Colorado just this past week. And we have heard about it a lot already. Just yesterday, a state court in Colorado, the state court judge who has been presiding over this attempt to keep Donald Trump off the ballot there in Colorado, making a finding that making the finding first that Donald Trump did engage in insurrection in violation of the language of the 14th Amendment. We've talked a lot about this in the past. This language that prohibits someone who has previously taken an oath of office from serving in a position of responsibility in government in the future, having violated that oath by engaging in insurrectionist conduct. The judge in Colorado finding just last night that indeed Donald Trump engaged in that insurrection, but also finding in the same order that she issued just last night that Donald Trump cannot be kept off the ballot. In particular, she is finding that this Civil War constitutional amendment barring insurrectionists from public office does not apply to the presidency. Her name is District Judge Sarah Wallace. This is the third ruling in a little over a week against lawsuits that seek to keep the former president from the ballot, citing this Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Previously, as you probably know well, the Minnesota Supreme Court just last week said that Trump could remain on the primary ballots because political parties have the sole choice over who appears. That the decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court, and a Michigan judge also ruled that Congress is the proper forum for deciding whether Section 3 applies to Trump. So we now have three judicial determinations that the former president will not be kept off the ballot in those three different states. Sarah Wallace, again, finding that the former president did in fact engage in insurrection as it's described in the 14th Amendment, but also determining, based upon her look at history, and saying in particular that part of the court's decision is its reluctance to embrace an interpretation of the law which would disqualify a presidential candidate without a clear and unmistakable indication that that was the intent of Section 3, the people who wrote that in the wake of the Civil War. These cases, of course, all important when it comes to the election coming up in 2024. The judge in Colorado, again, finding insurrectionist behavior by Donald Trump, but finding that that was not the intent of the authors of the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of it, does not specifically refer to the presidency, she says, does refer to members of the U.S. House of Representatives. Instead, the clause refers to an elector of the president and vice president, along with civil and military officers. She interprets that language not to apply to the presidency, and so says that those who would petition to keep Donald Trump's name off the ballot in Colorado, just as those courts in Minnesota and Michigan have also done, that those efforts cannot be successful, his name appears. Still, many proceedings throughout this nation that focus upon the attempt to keep Donald Trump off the ballots in the coming primary and perhaps ultimately the general election, if indeed he is the nominee of the Republican Party as that matter goes ahead. In our final moments, we're going to turn back, as I promised, the Supreme Court. It's a couple of major things happening in the Supreme Court just this past week. One of them, after many, many months of concerns about the legitimacy, not only of what the Supreme Court does, but specifically the behaviors of Supreme Court justices with respect to not recusing themselves in cases in which they may have personal interests and accepting other forms of remuneration, other gifts and benefits. Supreme Court announcing on Monday an adoption of an ethics code. When we come back, we'll talk about whether that's really what they did and also talk about why this is so significant for the current docket of the Supreme Court, focusing, among other things, upon challenges to our administrative agencies in our nation. Stay with us for that final discussion here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Late. Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
I'm so stressed about my business not being ready for the holidays.
Ooma.
What is that? Meditation?
I'm recommending the Ooma cloud phone system with auto attendant and more than 35 features.
Ooma?
Yep. Switching to Ooma is a cinch. Starts at $19.95 per month per user, plus taxes and fees.
Ooma.
Now you're feeling it. Visit Ooma.com. That's OOMA.com to learn more. Ooma, smart communications for the smarter business.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
Back once again on Saturday morning. Thank you for staying with me in this, our final segment of our Saturday morning broadcast, talking as we often do in our last moments together about the United States Supreme Court. A couple of very important things going on in that high court, especially on Monday of this past week, when plainly responding to weeks, months, and months of criticism and concern about the work, the labor, the focus, the behavior of Supreme Court justices when it comes to not recusing themselves from cases in which they may have personal interests or personal interests related to the friends who may be appearing in front of them in cases both historical and current, and also receiving benefits, gifts, travel, all kinds of things, focusing in particular, although not exclusively, upon Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas and the things that we have talked about at great length on this broadcast, other broadcasts of civic media. This past week, in the wake of attempts by the United States Congress to impose a formal code of ethics that has not only a set of principles by which the Supreme Court would guide its conduct in deciding cases or not deciding cases, that unsuccessful because even though the legislation proceeded to the full well of the Senate, not enough votes in the Senate to adopt the legislation that would establish that code and also, importantly, provide an enforcement mechanism for it. How does it effectively get enforced? That legislation stymied on Capitol Hill, right across the parking lot from the Supreme Court there on Capitol Hill, this past Monday, plainly responding in part, and I would offer incompletely, imperfectly, to these calls for the establishment of a code of ethics, John Roberts and all of the other members of the Supreme Court issuing what they called a statement of the court regarding the code of conduct and describing a code of conduct that was released in paper form. It's worth reading. It's about 9 pages long, kind of thing that you can digest along the way. The so-called code of conduct includes several canons, several principles, things like a justice should uphold the integrity and independence of the judiciary. A justice should avoid impropriety and the appearance of impropriety in all activities. And a justice may engage in extrajudicial activities that are consistent with the obligations of the judicial office. All of those a part of this. Significantly, the justices announce and the Chief Justice articulates in a preliminary statement, he acknowledges that for the most part, these rules and principles, there's nothing new here to see, he says. It's basically a compilation of all the kinds of things that we have understood, that we have been guided by in the past. And although this is a good step in the first direction, at least it's acknowledgement that there is an issue here, that we are rightly concerned about the conduct of our Supreme Court. It is significant to note, and I've done some counting here, the word must, that is obligations under this so-called code, appears 6 times in this document. The word should, that is the word should, appears 53 times. A whole lot more indication that these are things that will be self-policing, that the justices themselves will have to determine on their own whether they are responsible for abiding by not only the regulations about other sources of income, but especially this issue related to recusals. Significant, and this is the principal criticism of what this document, this compilation of canons and of principles, the principal concern here is just this, that there is no enforcement mechanism. There's no mechanism here for any of this to be administered, unlike the mechanisms that are set forth in the principles and codes of conduct that apply to all of the other federal judges, the circuit court judges, the appeals court judges, and the district court judges in our nation. There's no enforcement mechanism. Instead, it's self-patrolling. It's self-compliant. And we're still reliant upon the good decision-making, discretion, the judgment. We hope it's wise. We hope it's decent of the individual justices. Nothing in this document compels the kinds of things that the lower courts are compelled to do when they have conflicts of interest, perceived conflicts of interest, requirements to disclose information about where their sources of income are coming from, all of that. No, and including along the way, no specific restrictions on gifts, travel, or real estate deals. But again, cautions that the justices should not take part in any activities that detract from the dignity of the justices' office, that interfere with the performance of their duties, or reflect adversely on the justices' impartiality. We hope that going forward, the not just footfalls, but the problems and the errors of the past by some of our Supreme Court justices are corrected. For now, this is how this story is going to remain. No legislative action. That's not possible. Unlikely the Supreme Court's going to come back and issue another kind of statement that will in any way enforce these in terms of a compulsion to act by the Supreme Court justices. Big news coming out of the Supreme Court just this past week. And finally, in our final moments, want to comment about why this is so important, underscoring once again some things we're going to chat about in future broadcasts, and that is the importance of the kinds of cases the Supreme Court is deciding these days. We've talked in recent broadcasts about the importance of the guns cases that are now before the Supreme Court, not only this Rahimi case having to do with a domestic violence violator, but also cases now pending before the Supreme Court when it comes to the legitimacy of bump stocks, turning a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon. A question about whether or not the First Amendment applies to someone who is discouraging involvement with gun promotion organizations. That case is pending before the Supreme Court. Question coming out likely from the Supreme Court having to do with bans of assault weapons in Illinois. Another question coming out of the Fifth Circuit about ghost guns. All of that pending before the Supreme Court in relation to their safety and security. And yet another set of cases, which we're going to talk about in our next broadcast. Yes, indeed, happening live next Saturday, the 25th. We're going to talk about something called the Chevron Doctrine, addressing this issue that's been out there for 40 years, has been resolved. It basically says that when the courts address issues interpreting the laws, if they're not quite clear, if there is a standard or practice or procedure that needs clarification, there is deference to the people who know about the law, deference to the scientists, the statisticians, the people who are expert in these areas. A case called Chevron, whether that should be overturned and courts should be permitted to substitute their decision-making for the decisions, the fact-based, the evidence-based decisions of people inside our federal agencies. A huge decision. Two cases pending before the Supreme Court right now in that area. Two other cases going to the legitimacy of the SEC, and as we know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as well. We are going to be back again next Saturday, right after Thanksgiving, to take up those issues and more. We invite you back to this broadcast. Call in. Be a part of our discussion. In the meantime, a best wish for all of you to have a pensive, a thoughtful, an endearing, an important time of consideration for Thanks in America this coming Thursday. Thanks for who we are. Thanks for the principles that guide us. And thanks for being a part of this broadcast. We'll see you again. We'll hear from you again next week, Saturday. Have a good week, everybody.
In touch with the City of Lakes. In touch with you. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station. Did you know this local radio station is part of Civic Media? Learn more about the entire network at civicmedia.us.
timeout.
All right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. It's one of the busiest travel weeks of the year and a very busy stretch of roadway. Interstate 10 in California is going to reopen in Los Angeles a little more than a week after it was heavily damaged by fire.
10,000.